Good morning. This is Elaine Warner Hudson along with Sarah Stucho, and we are here for our show Imagine. How are you doing today, Sarah?
I'm doing great, Elaine. How are you?
I'm doing good. Super.
So today we are going to talk about the top 10 myths in teenage and adolescent addiction and what they are and what the reality is, what the truth is behind those myths. And then we're going to go into our Project Josh, our Sober Companion Angel program, and we're going to introduce that to you, and it's going to be really exciting.
I'm looking forward to talking about this because, you know, Sarah, as a parent myself, I was so unaware of drug use and even the signs that my son was ever using. So I'm really excited to be able to present this to parents to help educate them so that they may know about this before it gets to the point of their kids using and possibly even overdosing. I don't even want to go there. That's just, I want to prevent that.
Right. So the first show we talked about, I just want to recap briefly, your story with Josh, who you lost to a heroin overdose. And then last week we had a special guest, Wes, on a 19-year-old who just survived a heroin overdose. And he talked about all the brain damage, the body damage, and what this means for him. So now we're going to talk about some of the top myths. If you don't know anything about addiction, these are common myths that you will probably think of yourself, and we just want to provide you with some education on what you need to know so that you do not believe the myth.
It's very important because, as I said before, you know, we don't have as parents the education about drugs unless we actually pursue it ourselves. And when our kids are growing up, how many of us have the time to do that? We're busy running them to and from different places. We're busy with them with our own lives. We have our own lives going on. So I'm really happy that we can bring this to parents to help them to know.
Yeah. And so before we get started, I just want to remind you that we are on adviceradio.com, the call-in number, if you want to call. And if you have questions or if you want to offer feedback or your own little tidbits as we talk, the number is area code 562-945-2777. So let's jump in and let's get started with myth number one. It will never happen to my kid, right? How many parents think that you're a good family, educated, you're well off, middle class, good values, maybe you go to church, you're surrounded by other good families, your kids are in sports, they're getting good grades, A's, maybe even B's, good health, no apparent signals that they're in danger or trouble or even at risk for turning to drugs or alcohol. Maybe you and your husband or your spouse never even drink or never even touch drugs growing up. So you have this belief that it could never happen to your kid. And that's the biggest myth, myth number one, because it's bigger than the family. This problem with drugs and alcohol is much bigger than your nuclear family. This is a social problem, a big social problem. It's not an individual disease. It's a social disease. It's a family disease. And, you know, things like having a good family might prevent your kids or provide a buffer, but it could still happen to your child. And Elaine, do you have any examples of that from your own work with these kids or your own personal life?
Oh, absolutely. What comes to mind first off is, as I spoke to 2 weeks ago about my son, Josh. I never thought he would ever use drugs, and there's a reason for that. The reason is that his greatest fear that he ever had was vomiting. So because he had this great fear of vomiting, it was totally not even a thought in my mind he would ever turn to drugs. I knew he was having some behavior problems. That was evident to me, but never thought twice about it. So, yeah, that's huge. And I also think that with a lot of parents that I've met with working with adolescents, that what they've told me is quite often what happens is their kids are so used to using drugs before they even know they've even started using that by the time that they find out, they feel like they're way behind. How do they catch up to where their kid is at that time, and what did they miss along the way? How come they didn't catch it?
Yeah, I often hear parents say after their kid's been using for 3 or 4 years, how did we get to this point? Like, what did I miss? What? How come I didn't see this?
Exactly. And I think it's because, first of all, I think with the myth that you're talking about here when you said that will never happen to my kid, there's somewhat of a denial around that, for myself anyway, because it's something I never wanted to think about happening. You know, thinking about that's really scary.
And so I want to point out the fact that even if your child is getting good grades, a student, in fact, students who are successful with their work, their school, their athletics can often mask their drug use a lot better than kids who are dropping out or not making the grades. So A students can use drugs for 2 or 3 years before it catches up with them. You know, they're what adults call functioning alcoholics or functioning addicts for a certain period of time because they can get by. They can make the grades. And you know, I read an interesting article that just because you're an athlete or you're successful at sports doesn't mean that that's going to prevent you from using. I mean, think about it. After you win a game, kids often go out to celebrate, especially in college. They'll hit the bar and they'll drink and they'll binge drink after a successful win. And so it's kind of built into these activities. So you have to be aware that it can happen to your kid, even if they have everything going for them.
Oh, absolutely. I was just thinking about all the adolescents I've spoken with and how they've told me they were actually using heroin, ecstasy, numerous types of drugs when they were in class. One kid snorted cocaine in class. The teacher didn't even see it. And then I'm also aware that a lot of times kids will take a drug for a test, like Adderall is a stimulant. Mm-hmm. And stimulants help you with tests if you take them before because it makes your brain more active. So there's a lot of reasoning behind this, but then there's a lot of denial as well.
And the other thing I want to say is successful kids often, you know, they push themselves to do the best at sports and athletics. So often they're the ones who are going to binge use because they're going to push the limits with their drug use. So that's something that you have to be aware of as a parent. The next myth is, you know, and this has to do with once your kid is using drugs, that they can stop on their own, that this is a choice. And that is a myth. They cannot stop on their own once they reach a certain point. This becomes a brain disease that they really have no control over, and they don't have the choice. The only time they really have a choice is in the very beginning. They have a voluntary choice of whether or not they are going to use drugs for the very first time. That's a choice. But once they ingest that powerful substance that takes over their mind and their body and their soul, they lose their free will. They don't have a choice.
Well, that's absolutely true because it changes the whole brain chemistry. And even after they're off drugs for a period of time, the problem is that their brain takes a long period of time to heal. It's not something that happens overnight. So using the brain can heal. And as we had Wes on last week, he actually has brain damage from using. And you can have brain damage that is permanent, which is really sad because I think that he sounded extremely brilliant. You wouldn't even know that he had brain damage.
Well, one of the newest cutting-edge technologies is to take scans of the brain when you go into a treatment center. And I know that Dr. Drew does this on the Celebrity Rehab show, which I think is fabulous. But Dr. Amen, the Amen Institute in Newport Beach, he's actually the one who kind of started this whole phenomenon with taking pictures of the brain to see what kind of damage has been caused to the brain. And he's got some great books out. The one is Making a Good Brain Great or something. But just look up Dr. Amen, and he'll actually outline, he'll show you pictures of how drugs affect the brain. But I just want to share a couple statistics here. It's estimated that 40 to 60% of the vulnerability to addiction is attributable to genetic factors. And genes affect the predisposition in these ways. They play an important role in determining a person's sensitivity to alcohol or drugs' pleasurable effects, the level of craving that they have for the alcohol or drug, and the extent of vulnerability to excessive drinking or drug dependence. So that's how genes affect the role of drugs or alcohol.
Well, I was going to say also, Sarah, that the genes are important, but also growing up in a family where you may have a mother or father using along with the genes, I mean, isn't that going to make it even more likely that your child will use?
Absolutely. I mean, it goes back to what you're modeling for your kids. And if they think that it's normal for parents to drink every day, even if you're not getting wasted, but even if you're drinking on a daily basis, it's a lifestyle habit that your kids are going to assume is normal or assume is healthy. And any doctor would tell you that a daily use of any drug or alcohol is not healthy. It's not normal. And we'll get into more of that when we talk about the family disease of addiction. So let's go into our third myth, which is the myth that a treatment center, a rehab, is going to cure your kid, that when they come out of treatment, they're going to be fine. They're going to be over their addiction, no more struggles, everything solved. And Elaine, I know you and I both know that that's a big myth. We've seen it firsthand. We work in these treatment centers. We see how they work. We see how they don't work. And why don't you share some of what you've learned about that?
Oh, definitely. I think that there is a place for treatment centers. Don't get me wrong. I think they're very valuable, particularly in the beginning when your child is detoxing, trying to get off the drug. Also, there's a lot of support with other young people there as well, along with therapy, group sessions, things of that nature. But to believe that in 30, 60, or 90 days that you are cured is not accurate. Reason being is, how long has your kid been using drugs? A lot of these kids have been using 2 and 3 years. How could they get over all of the cravings or the desire to stop using in 30, 60, 90 days? Especially, again, like we were just speaking a couple minutes ago about how it changes the brain chemistry. It's not just the fact that they need to get to the source of the problem of why they begin to use, but it's also their brain needs to heal. And this takes a long time. And I'm sure, Sarah, you probably are very aware of how much time it can take for a brain to heal.
Yeah, so I want to say treatment centers, like Elaine said, are very valuable for interrupting the cycle of addiction. When your child is in the midst of their addictive cycle, meaning the drugs are active in their brain chemistry, their brain chemistry is reacting to the ups of being high and then the withdrawals, they need an interruption to that process in their brain. And that's what a treatment center does. It prevents them from using drugs, which feeds into that cycle. So that's very important. It's very good for detoxing. It's very good for them to be around other addicts their age, because often teens isolate when they're using and they are lonely and they have no friends and they're bored. And so a treatment center provides social support for them with other kids their age, which is very important.
I was going to say that it is incredible how important that is, because they have a bond, because they're there for the same purpose. They have an addiction to a drug. Mm-hmm. And what I really love watching is how they all bond and they're there for each other and they can relate to what that's all about. And they'll talk about their drug stories and how they started, and they'll be able to relate with things in their life, maybe personal things that happened with their sensitivity or their anxiety when they were very young, how they were unable to cope with those things. So that was the beginning of their drug use. But definitely that is a huge part. And I think even after they get out of treatment, that it's great that they get involved with kids that are in recovery as well.
Yeah, absolutely. They definitely need that social support because addicts like to be loners. They like to isolate, and that is the worst thing possible for them because other people hold them accountable, and they feel the need. They'll hold themselves more accountable when they're in the midst of other people. When they isolate, they let themselves hurt themselves, you know, they don't take care of themselves. But when they know that they have to be around others, they will take care of themselves. The other thing I want to point out that you shared, Elaine, which is the most important, is that if, you know, you can't expect a 30, 60, or 90-day program to cure something that has been going on for a long time. And the reality is that addiction and substance abuse is a chronic disease that needs to be managed on a daily basis for years to come, sometimes an entire lifetime. So you have to quit viewing addiction as an interruption in someone's life. It's a chronic disease. It takes several years of daily management. So you have to think about it kind of like if you have diabetes.
Or cancer.
Yeah, or cancer. You have to think about long-term management skills and programs to address addiction.
Absolutely, because it doesn't go away overnight. And I know that. I've talked to a lot of people just because of my own experience with losing a son to heroin who have said that they're dealing with it years later where they have to be very aware because those cravings, which we talked about a lot last program with Wes, those cravings are so huge. And, you know, sometimes even 6, 10 years later, their memory is still there of what that drug made them feel like.
Yeah, Wes said it brilliantly. He said I can't remember his exact words, but he said it's like fried and ingrained in your neurons and in your brain patterns, and you just never forget that sensation. And I've heard that from heroin addicts who have been clean for 10 years and all of a sudden they'll get a craving or they'll get a flashback. And it's like that one little instance could throw them back into, you know, using again after being clean for 10 years. You see it a lot with Alcoholics Anonymous. You always hear stories of people being sober for 10, 15 years, and then all of a sudden they get this craving and they go out and they have a drink, and then before you know it, they've got a DUI and they're in jail. And it's like, it's just so quickly it can take them over in an instant. And that's why you have to view this as a chronic disease that needs to be managed.
Well, and I guess that's where the saying comes from, one day at a time.
Yep, absolutely. Let's move on to myth number 4. And this has to do with the myth of the pink cloud. And Elaine, this is kind of up your alley, so why don't you share what this means?
The pink cloud is when an addict has detoxed, they look at what they've been doing, their use of the drugs, how insane it is, particularly if they've been using IV, if they've been using heroin, IV use. They can't believe that they really have done that. And when that occurs, they say, like when it happened with Josh, my own particular experience with this, he happened to be in jail, and he called me on the phone and he said, "Mom, I cannot believe that I was shooting needles, putting needles in my veins and shooting up with heroin." He said, "That's totally insane." So they have this, I guess I would like to say that vision or this expectation in their mind that once they've reached this point of this pink cloud, that everything's going to be okay. Mm. It's all gone away because they see how crazy it is. And that brings in just what we were talking about again, about the cravings. And they do know that. But then when the cravings come and they don't feel strong, that's the first thing they're going to go back to doing, is when something comes up in their life they can't handle, what did they do before? They used a drug to help.
So often the pink cloud hits while they're in treatment because it's the first time that the cycle of addiction has been interrupted and they've been sober for an extended period of time, meaning a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And so they start to feel better. Your body starts to heal. You get clearer in your head. You get more energy. You're sleeping better. You just start to feel better. And then, you know, you start to think, wow, I can't believe I was doing all of that. Being sober feels so great. But this is the pink cloud.
It is. And you know that I've also noticed that a lot of these young people, when they come in to the residential center, they look thin and gaunt because they've lost so much weight, because all they're doing is using drugs. That's what they're, where their mind is. That's all they care about doing. And when they start looking healthy, they're amazed to look at what they look like when they came in.
Yes.
And that's part of that pink cloud too, of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, you know, I'm, and when they're in there with that support with the other adolescents their age, and they have that bond, and there's a lot of strength in that. So that when they leave the program, if they don't have the support like that with other kids that are trying to get healthy, they tend to isolate, and when they isolate, that is when they start thinking about using, and they start wanting to, they start craving again.
Absolutely. And it's just really important for parents and teens out there that are struggling with addiction to realize that this pink cloud is a real phenomena. You will feel this when you're in this state of feeling like you're on the top of the world. You can conquer addiction. You know, you need a reality check. You need to remember this is the pink cloud. And, you know, your thoughts and feelings could quickly shift, because often kids in this state will advocate to their parents, no, I never want to do drugs. I promise you I'm never going to do it. I just want to go back home and go to school. And they push for what they want, but they're in the midst of the pink cloud. And studies actually show that teens who leave a treatment center after 30 days of treatment often will relapse within the first 30 days of leaving that treatment center.
Well, part of that too, Sarah, has to do with the triggers. Knowing this is a family disease, they go back home with their family, and even though their family may be working on the issues within themselves, they go back to reminders. The triggers are reminders of their room, where they stash the drugs in their room. There's all these familiar places that trigger all these thoughts of using. So it's very hard for them. It's not like they want to do this.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up, because it reminds me of a client I had who was going back home, but she was afraid to go back to her room, and she was afraid of what drugs were stashed in her room. And so we developed a plan where dad was going to go through her room and search and get rid of the drugs. And then they together were going to remodel the room, repaint the walls, buy new sheets, buy new comforter, get new furniture, so that she didn't have to be reminded of using in that room with all that old furniture, and in that environment. So those, I mean, these are things, practical things that probably people won't think about, that we want to make sure that you and our audience and teens think about these things. So let's move on. The next myth is the myth of the adult addict. And what this means is, say your teen is in treatment and they're 17 years old. Maybe they're on the verge of turning 18. And you as a parent are saying, well, in a month they're going to be 18 and they're going to be an adult. And at that point, I really have no say over, you know, what they can do. They're in charge of their life. Well, that's a myth. And we're going to tell you why. Do you want to start, Elaine? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I've actually seen this happen. And I'm thinking, how can you be like 17 one day, 18 the next day, all of a sudden, you've got your own life. You're responsible for yourself. Your parents no longer responsible for you. But you can't grow mentally in one day. It makes no difference between 17 and 18, if you know what I'm talking about. It's kind of a crazy thought.
Right. And so ask yourself, what does being adult mean? So an adult is physically independent, psychologically independent, financially independent, emotionally independent. That's an adult. I don't care what age you are. I know some 35-year-olds who aren't independent,
yeah,
who I wouldn't call an adult, and they're not even addicts. So if you have someone on drugs, who isn't independent in these ways, they're definitely not an adult.
Oh, that's definitely true, because you know what, Sarah? They don't grow past the age when they started using. So they could be an 18-year-old and say they started using at 15. They still have a 15-year-old emotional brain because their brain doesn't develop any further.
Right. So the age at which they first use is typically the age they are when they get clean and sober, because they haven't learned how to process life experiences with a sober mind or a sober emotional system. So they haven't learned how to deal with a romantic breakup without self-medicating. They haven't learned how to deal with failure. They haven't learned how to deal with success without medicating themselves. You know, some teens will abuse drugs because they won a game or they were successful and they'll want to celebrate. But they haven't learned to grow emotionally or psychologically without drugs. And so when they get sober, they're really that 13-year-old, even if they're numerically 20 years old.
Well, I think as a parent, Sarah, it's our responsibility when they turn from 17 to 18 and they're an addict for us to step in and say, okay, you're not having a cell phone here for a while. You know, that's the first thing that should be taken away, because, you know, that's the way they get their drugs.
So let's talk about that. So, you know, as a parent, you're probably thinking, well, what can I do? Well, let's, you know, if you're paying for your kid's cell phone, stop. And I don't care what age they are. If you have a 12-year-old who starts using drugs, the first thing you need to do is take away their cell phone. A cell phone is a privilege. It's not a right. And let me tell you, the cell phone is the first tool that they use to score their drugs. So when they can prove that they're sober, you give them back their cell phone. In the meantime, if your kid's using drugs, you take the phone away, you disconnect that number, you throw out that cell phone because they've got drug dealer numbers plugged into it. They don't need to have that phone, period.
Well, because that's the first thing they're going to do. I mean, when they get a craving, the first thing they're going to do is look up their drug dealer.
Correct.
And believe me, they know how to do that, and it can happen with the snap of a finger.
The second thing is money. If your kid comes to you and says, oh, I need $20 to go to a movie, no, they're not going to use that money on a movie. They're going to use it on drugs. I don't care what dollar amount. Mom, I need $3 for Taco Bell, or I need $4 for lunch. No. If you know that your kid is using drugs, no, absolutely no cash, because they will not spend it on what they are saying. They will spend it on drugs.
It's just enabling them. It's just giving them a means to be able to score the drugs.
The only thing as a parent that you are responsible for is food, shelter,
and love.
And as a parent, I'm sure you have a house that they live in and you have food in your refrigerator. So they need to learn how to open the refrigerator and get food and come home and sleep in their bed. And that's all they need. And your love, of course. But by all means, you got to watch the money that you give them, and you got to cut off the cell phone at any age. Even if they're an adult and you're paying for their cell phone, you need to stop, because the cell phone is the main tool that they use to get their drugs. And if you wanted, you could probably even contact, I mean, I wish people like the police would get more involved, and maybe we can do that, or the DEA, but you could probably turn over their cell phone to the police or the DEA and say, hey, go through this phone. I'm sure you might find a drug dealer's number in here.
Well, actually, that happened with Josh. I had his cell phone after he passed away, and I reported it, and they did find someone that was dealing drugs, and they actually staked out the area, but they have to have proof that they're selling. And proof would be going through their garbage. There's just certain things they have to do, or if they see a lot of traffic going in and out of that house. So I think that's really important, Sarah, what you brought up, because that if those phone numbers are turned in, they will investigate. They did investigate for me.
Wow, I'm so glad to hear that. I'm so glad to hear that. And you never know, maybe there's old text messages in your son or daughter's phone that could be evidence of use. I mean, you never know. I'm so glad to hear that, Elaine. That's wonderful.
Well, it was huge for me, because even though I didn't have him anymore, I thought if I could get this drug dealer off the street selling, that would save another kid's life. So, you know, I think as parents, we all have to look at this and work together. How are we going to help each other out here? We know there's problems in school. We know that there's problems as parents. What are we going to do as parents? Because we can't do this all on our own. And we need to take a break right now and come back. And I think we need to discuss that more.
Yeah, we will. We're going to get into some of the other myths that will address what parents can do, what the myths at school are. So that's going to be real exciting. You don't want to miss that. We're going to go on a short break here. We are on adviceradio.com. The call-in number again is 562-945-2777. Thanks.
When people say you're bright, they mean you've got a lot going on up there. It's not something people who use drugs hear much, because over time, drugs can change their brain. And the more times they try drugs, the more they want them. It's called addiction, and it's a disease that will waste your brain. For information, visit StopDrugAddiction.org or call 1-800-729-6686.
Huh? You talking to me? All right. I'm supposed to tell you that, hello, I'm supposed to tell you that whenever I listen to AM 1680, I enjoy acting up with Skyler and Steve, although right now they're not acting up too much because I broke both their legs. Thank you.
Visit us online for show archives and more at actinguptoshow.com. Follow us at twitter.com/actinguptoshow.
Hi, everyone. This is Tony Aiello. Hey, recently my wife was involved in a car accident, and thankfully she was uninjured. But our 2006 Corolla wasn't. It was a wreck. I brought my car to Advance Auto Body in Santa Fe Springs to get it fixed. And let me tell you, they did a great job. My experience with them was quick, efficient, and their quality? Well, let's just say I couldn't even tell our car was involved in an accident. In a state-of-the-art facility, the team at Advance Auto Body are collision repair specialists, and they work with all the major insurance carriers. They're family-owned and operated, and they've been serving the La Mirada area since 1994. You can call 562-802-1215 or stop by and say hi to Francis and Jerry. They're located right up the street from Valley View Avenue at 14,000 Rosecrans Avenue. That's 14,000 Rosecrans Avenue in Santa Fe Springs. Advance Auto Body, 562-802-1215. That's 562-802-1215 for Advance Auto Body, your collision repair specialists.
Lifestyles, I'm Deborah Wetzel. Every bride wants to look beautiful on her wedding day, and achieving that perfect look is easy with some expert advice on the right beauty products. Kelly Kwan, celebrity makeup artist, says a little preparation can make the day go a lot smoother.
Being prepared is the key to pulling off a gorgeous look, so select products that can multitask. For example, choose a creamy lipstick that doubles as a blush, and use petroleum jelly, which adds shine to lips or can be dabbed on hair to prevent flyaways.
And since brides spend most of their big day smiling for the camera and guests, how should they keep their smile looking luminous?
Prior to the big day, get in the habit of brushing with a battery-operated toothbrush to remove surface stains and a paste that restores whiteness to teeth. These are also great tools to bring along for quick smile touch-ups in between the ceremony and reception. Also, be sure to choose lipstick colors that have a blue or cool undertone, like a mauve or pale rose. These will make a bride's beam look extra white through all her wedding day photos.
I'm Deborah Wetzel.
There is a way to avoid pesticide use. This is Nick Fedoroff with today's Things Green Garden Minute, but first. Believe it or not, there is a way to avoid the use of pesticides, insecticides, and all the other sides that are toxic to you and I. And it's really simple to do if you follow through properly. First off, start with healthy plants in and around your garden, as well as your house plants. A plant that is healthy will ward off any insect or disease. So that means you're going to need to stay on top of fertilizing and correctly watering your plants so that the immune system of the plant does not deteriorate, therefore encouraging this kind of activity. Another practice to keep on top of is deadheading spent flowers. Once a flower has provided the color and the beauty that it had to offer, you need to get rid of it. Clearing away fallen leaves and debris is another way to deny pests of a place to live. And finally, mechanical controls such as hand picking and using barrier traps is a great way to avoid pesticide use. This is Nick Fedoroff with today's Things Green Garden Minute.
How to deal with someone who says that's so gay. Turn it around.
Did your mom cut the crust off your peanut butter and jelly sandwich? That is so gay.
Oh, yeah? How would you like it if I said that so guy who makes fun of other people's sandwiches mostly because he's secretly jealous of them and who also has ketchup on his face?
Okay, geez. Sorry. Wait, do I seriously have ketchup on me? When you say that's so gay, do you realize what you say? Knock it off. Learn more at thinkbeforeyouspeak.com. Brought to you by Glisten and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Imagine Show. I'm here, Elaine Warner-Hudson, with my co-host, Sarah Stuchel. And I'd like to also remind you to please check out our website, which is www.projectjosh.org. It's a foundation that we have where you can donate money, and we'll tell you in just a little bit what that money goes for. It's a great organization, and it is actually on the Advice Radio's website, and you can also look under the website that I gave you. And again, we're on Advice Radio, and we'd like to take calls if anyone would like to call. It is 562-945-2777. Welcome back, Sarah.
Well, I'm glad to be here, and let's continue with our myths. And we're reviewing common myths in teen and adolescent and young adult substance abuse and addiction issues. We're on myth number 6, and this myth is the only one who needs to change here is the addict. If they would just quit using, everyone would be fine. And we're here to tell you that is a myth, that addiction is a family disease. And Elaine, do you want to jump into?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a real eye-opener for parents when they find out that it's not all about their kid. And they are able to see ways that they impacted their kid in the ways, different ways when they were growing up. So often I think we look at this, because I did. I thought that, oh, how did this happen? How did Josh get there? And looking back in his childhood, as I mentioned on the first program, there's a lot of stress that he went through with the marriage I was in. And I think that added a lot because he was really sensitive. And most of these kids are really sensitive, kind human beings. And so, you know, I think that's what comes into play here is a lot of times we just think like, this kid can get off drugs, they should be able to be okay, not recognizing that we have to, some changes we have to do as a family.
Absolutely. Addiction and drug abuse, alcoholism affects the entire family. So even though they're the ones struggling with the addiction, it's still going to affect you. And we're not here to blame parents or families, but we're here to say that it's all interrelated. Often teens and adolescents self-medicate because of dysfunctional emotional systems in the family. They often feel responsible for caretaking their parents on emotional levels or psychological levels. They often feel a lack of love and support from their parents. We see this a lot in upper or middle to upper class families where kids don't feel the love because their parents spend a lot of money on them. And deep down, you know, intellectually, they know their parents love them, but they just don't feel it. They don't have that love bond, that emotional connection.
You know, it's true, Sarah. I was going to say maybe next week or week after that, we go a little bit into the family roles, how kids take on where they pick up where their parents are not. And they can actually take over as a parent. They can be parenting their parents and to take care, to make sure things are running right. And I think that would be a great thing because I found that really fascinating, the different roles as kids that they take on because their parents are not able to be there as a family or as an authority within the family.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many factors that, you know, prevent parents from parenting effectively. And, you know, they get caught up in their work. They get caught up with the stresses of the economy, financial demands. But kids are smart and kids are aware of what's lacking in the family system, especially when it comes to emotional needs.
Well, Sarah, what is this whole thing about? I hear so often where kids don't have dinner with their families. I'm shocked. I can't believe that family doesn't have dinner together. What happened with that one? I thought that was a given.
Well, I'm just going to quickly, since you brought that up, share with you five characteristics of a healthy family. So if you're sitting there saying, well, what does a healthy family look like? Here, I'm going to share with you just real quickly because we don't have a whole lot of time, but maybe we can go into this in a later show. The first one is flexibility. Healthy family systems have a flexibility that allows them to make changes in the balance, structure, and functioning of the system as circumstances and people change and grow. So they're not rigid. They're flexible. They adapt. They're open. The next one is security. Healthy family systems have members that are committed to maintaining relationships and positive regard among the group. They want to spend meaningful time with each other. Collective identity. Healthy families maintain their collective identity over time. The rules and expectations are clear and consistent. Rules are not chaotic and fluid. And rules can change as they need to. Tradition. And this goes into having family dinners together. Healthy families have traditions. They maintain traditions that create a sense of family identity and imparts a sense of individual identity and continuity among the family members. Tradition is often the glue that binds a family together, with each person feeling that they are part of something special. The last one, real quickly, is spirituality. Families that have shared religious or spiritual values, traditions, or rituals or routines tend to be able to weather all kinds of personal and family tribulations.
Well, I'm glad that you read what you read to us, because that explains then why it's a family disease.
Absolutely, because all these things go to the wayside, when teens are self-medicating and caught up in their addiction.
The concept is so simple.
It really is.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it really is. Because you're right, I can't tell you how many kids I know that come to treatment and they say, well, we never have dinner together, or we never go on vacation together. We don't do anything together.
Well, I think a lot of times with parents being really busy, and not adding guilt trips to any parents here, but we tend to think, if I buy my kid this, they'll really know I appreciate them and love them. I'll buy this for them. I'll give them this money for this because I'm not there. I'm so busy with my job. I've got this going on, that going on. And I think that a lot of times that is really powerful for parents to take a look at that, because I know, talking to a lot of the kids, that they really don't want all those things.
They don't. They want love. They want time together, quality time.
Yes, and that to them is precious and priceless. They don't want the material possessions. Those get old, actually. Those get really old to them.
Yeah, they do. They do. Let's jump ahead. The myth number 7 is the myth that an overdose is a wake-up call to the addict. That, they just overdosed. They just landed in the hospital. This will wake them up. This will somehow make them not stop using drugs from here on out. They can't possibly want to use after suffering this terrible overdose. That is the biggest myth of all. And actually, this is the most scariest time for you as a family, because this simply means that the addict's body is so worn down that the next time they use, they will probably die. And they do not want to stop. They didn't intend to overdose. An overdose was an accident.
Oh, are you kidding me, Sarah? That happened with Josh. 4 days before he passed away, he overdosed, went to the hospital, acted like nothing happened when we walked into the room, and he passed away 4 days later. It's almost like they're so caught up with that drug. They know they have the possibility of dying. They know they have the possibility of overdosing. But that drug is so powerful, that craving so intense, that that doesn't matter. It becomes their main priority in their life, and it's what they live for.
And this is why you have to understand that it is not a choice. They do not have a choice when they reach this kind of level of drug or alcohol dependence. It's beyond them having a choice to stop using. It is actually a brain disease. And for all you parents that want to learn more about how it affects the brain, I want to encourage you to go to the National Institute of Drug Abuse website, NIDA.gov. They've got great information on there on how the drugs actually impact the brain, the neurotransmitters, how it becomes this recursive cycle in the brain, and you really need to educate yourself.
Well, and I think it goes beyond that, too. I think we need to get the education out there in schools. I'm talking to these young people, and they're telling me that in middle school, they get somewhat of an education about drugs, but once they get into high school, it's not talked about anymore. And there's a lot of denial in these schools that there's drug use.
So
it's rampant.
Yeah, let's go into that, because that's our next myth. Our next myth is that, oh, the schools are safe. The schools, they're not going to, you know, we can trust the schools to protect our kids from being exposed to drugs. And that is the biggest myth. Let me ask you a question as parents. If you knew that half the school were bringing loaded guns to class, would you let your kid go to school? Would you let your kid actually go sit in a classroom where half the students there had loaded guns in their pocket or their backpack?
Oh, that is totally insane. That thought is insane. But really, it's not any different than the drugs.
Drugs are just as deadly. Drugs can kill your kid in an instant or over a long couple years.
Wow, I never thought of it that way, Sarah. That's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And you know what? I think that we need to get out there as parents, or maybe I should say you and I need to get out there to educate some of these schools. I would love to talk at some of the schools and
share.
And
you brought this up before the show. Share about the one student who said they were passing out Adderall yesterday.
Oh, there's one particular adolescent that I'm involved with texting back and forth. He is trying to get off drugs. He told me he did really well on a test, and I texted him back and said, "That's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that." And then he asked me a question. He said, "What does Adderall do to you?" I went, "This is crazy. He's telling me he used Adderall before this test." Well, Adderall is a stimulant that they use for ADHD kids. And it is helpful before a test to take a stimulant. I'm not telling you to go do that. But he wanted me to know, that's the way he told me, that he had used it before his test and he scored a good score on his test. This is scary.
And the kids were passing this out before the exam. So almost everyone in the class was taking Adderall before the exam,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. That's what it was just like. It was every day. Just like, you know, it's almost like popping your vitamin C pill in the morning.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I've heard, you know, kids will go into parents' medicine cabinets and take the pills and sell them at school, you know, $4 a pill. Or, you know, often now kids are starting off with cough syrup in the medicine cabinet. They're getting high off of that because
everything needs to be locked up. Everything. Even if you think it's a drug that your kid can't have any side effects to, don't leave any prescription drugs out. Lock them up. Because believe me, kids are looking. I mean, they're looking into all kinds of things. I mean, just like you said, cough syrup that seems so innocent that you can pick up in a grocery store. Those things should be put away.
Mm-hmm. And we all owe it to each other to look out for each other. I mean, this is, like I said at the beginning, this is a big social problem. And one parent alone can't fight this. We all need to work together to protect each other. It's devastating when you see, you know, a young child that you watch grow up, a student, pro athlete, all of a sudden get hooked on drugs and throw his whole life away, you know, his junior or senior year of high school. That's devastating, and it breaks your heart even if you knew the kid growing up. So we all need to watch out for each other and, you know, protect each other's children.
Absolutely, because, Sarah, you know what? These kids will not tell on one another. I've talked to them a lot. They will not tell. Even if they know that their friend is in danger of actually dying, they will not tell on them. And that's a serious problem, because I've even asked these kids, well, would you go to a counselor? I mean, could you go to maybe not their parents, but could you go to a counselor, kind of an in-between mediator kind of person, and open up and tell them that your friend is using drugs? And they're like going, I'm not going to rat on my friend. Isn't that sad that it could cost their friend their life? And if something like that happens, where do you think that's going to leave that kid for the rest of their lives?
Right. Right. I know. It's really sad. Let's quickly jump in. The next myth is that the 12-step AA is the only way. And we're not here to bash AA. Actually, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12-step program offers some very valuable pieces. You know, it offers a free community. It's a free social support network. And they really focus on helping addicts develop their spirituality, which is essential. I mean, everyone needs to develop their spirituality. Now, what AA does not provide is the formal treatment for the underlying issues that often exist with addiction, like anxiety or depression or a personality disorder or a different mental illness. All of that, you need to seek formal treatment from a psychiatrist, a licensed marriage and family therapist, a psychologist, a medical expert team, because they often coexist. So you can't view AA as treatment. You view AA as support, valuable support. It's free. It's available any time of the day, and it will help your child and even adults develop their spirituality.
Oh, absolutely. And I think they can relate to others who are in their same shoes. And that's what's important here, is for them to feel like they're not alone and to have the support of a sponsor. I think the program's absolutely wonderful. But you do bring up a really honest opinion, issue about the 12-step program, is that it is a good program, but it does not get to the bottom of whatever the person's needs may be. It's a good support group. It's good to have a sponsor. It's good to have someone you can call. That's all, I think, really great. So, but I think that, again, there's more that needs to be done, definitely.
The last myth is the myth that people believe that there is nothing they can do to prevent their child from using drugs. So it's kind of like when you feel hopeless or like there's nothing you can do. And that's a myth. There's plenty you can do. We kind of talked a little bit about the first thing you do is you take away their cell phone because that's a privilege. You stop giving them money. You, Elaine, do you have any?
Oh, absolutely. You make sure they don't hang out with the drug friends they were hanging out with. You keep an eye on them. And you make sure, take away their car.
Yeah.
If they're able to drive, take away their car. Make sure that you know where they're at all times. This is part of the issue of when they get out of treatment. They need to be closely watched.
Right. So this is kind of the bridge into the program that we offer here at Project Josh. And it's called the Sober Companion Guardian Angel Program. So what happens is once they get out of treatment, you need to be thinking about a long-term treatment plan. We talked about how addiction is a chronic disease. It takes years, and it needs to be managed on a daily basis. So with our Sober Companion program, we structure a program for a minimum of a year after treatment. And, you know, maybe your teen goes back to school, and they're at school from 8 to 2, and then maybe they've got sports from 2 to 4. Well, then maybe they've got some free time. On the weekends or in the evenings. And what we do is we match you up with a sober companion that will spend the downtime that your child has together. We like to use MFT intern or trainees, which are marriage and family therapists, or even people who specialize in addiction like KDACs. We like to use them to spend one-on-one time just helping your teen reintegrate back into society. So, you know, they'll be with someone who can help them overcome their cravings on a moment-to-moment basis, learn healthy behaviors on a moment-to-moment basis. You know, they can sit down and have family dinners with you and help facilitate wonderful family conversations that help connect you together to one another, to talk about difficult issues over dinner.
Also to teach them to have fun.
Mm. Yeah, that's the big piece.
This is huge, Sarah. I can tell you from two deaths that I've seen, from one being my son and another a very dear young man that I knew. They both told me they didn't know how to have fun. So we want to go out there and teach these kids how to have fun, things that they really want to do. And these kids are open for this. That's what's
yes.
really great. They would love to have a companion that they can do this with that's available. And we can do a lot of different kinds of things depending upon the needs or the wants or the desire of each individual, what they like to do.
Right, because part of it also is helping these kids find their purpose and passion in life. And that's what they have to live for. If you're not living for your passion, you're not living. And these kids aren't living to begin with. They're bored. Often why they turn to drugs and alcohol is out of boredom and not knowing how to have fun. So we want to help them grow in their passion, find out, discover what that is. Take them on group trips with other kids their age who are involved in our program. Take them on fun trips, maybe to Europe, maybe on a ski trip, maybe to Hawaii, maybe hiking some mountain in Russia. You know, all that would be to be determined depending on how many kids we have enrolled in our program. But we want to show them what life is really about.
That you don't need drugs to have fun. You know, I've heard from some of these kids that have been off drugs for a couple years how they've said, I'm having more fun than I ever had on drugs. I think they found that little niche in their life of things that they enjoy doing, their hobbies, what they live for, the purpose of their family. Their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
That's all so important. And the joy of life, of going out and living and having fun and being able to do it without relying on drugs.
Right, because drugs has become their way of coping with life, not living life. And we're going to help them on a daily basis, one-on-one basis, learn the skills to live successfully. I think we have a call here. Maybe not. Okay, no call.
I guess we don't.
That's okay.
No, what you were saying, Sarah, is really true. We want them to go out into society to learn to be able to even get a job. I mean, most of them don't even know what to do, how to work, or what they need to do after they get out of recovery. They're just lost. And as we said before, they have a lot of time on their hands. But to let them know that there is a purpose in their life. And through this whole time, they also can grow up to the age that they are. Because they're not going to be using drugs, so they're going to become more mature. And they're going to be able to find the things in life that make them happy, things that they love that maybe they never even knew about.
Absolutely. And now, if you're in our audience and you're sitting there wondering, well, how much does this cost? This sounds like it could be expensive. A sober companion spending all this one-on-one time, you know, maybe 20, 30 hours a week with my child sounds fabulous, you know, because first of all, they'd be keeping my kid out of trouble. I mean, in some ways, it's like a babysitter, but it's not because it's so much more than a babysitter. It's a trained therapist who is going to be teaching your child skills to live life.
And interacting with them.
Yes. And so it's, you know, it's provided, we're a nonprofit, so we don't charge an enormous rate. We are funding it through the nonprofit, and we work on a sliding scale. We rely on our donations to help fund this for you and your family. So we can make it fit within your budget.
Absolutely, and I think that's why I'd like to bring up again where they can find out about this and where they can donate money. At www.projectjosh.org, and go there. And if you would like to donate some money, it's going for a wonderful cause. You're helping to save a kid's life, because I think we pretty much have proven, talking earlier, that they need more than just a recovery program.
And we're going to help your child manage their chronic illness.
Absolutely.
And the family. We're there for you, too. The Sober Companion is there for you as a family. So thank you for joining us today on the Top 10 Myths. And I don't know if we had 10. We might have cut one off. But thanks for joining us on the myths. We are going to try and get a drug dealer on as our next guest.
Oh, I think that'd be fabulous.
We haven't confirmed, but I think it's going to be really important for parents to hear how these drug dealers get to your kids.
How do they lure them in for wanting them to use? I mean, some of these kids probably have never used anything, and A lot of times I hear that they're older kids that try to pull them in.
And, you know, what they're actually cutting these drugs with, what your child may actually be ingesting.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you again. You're on we're on AdviceRadio.com.
We'll see you next week. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
I've been running around, chasing all that I long to hold.